people in the community interacting with the police in a positive way. I'm calling for a special prosecutor in this case, and police need to be held accountable, just like any other profession, if they screw up.
We're going to leave it there. Michael Oppenheimer, the lawyer for the Paul O'Neill family, and Charlene Carruthers. Charlene Carruthers is national director of the Black Youth Project 100. We will have a conversation about what happened in Pakistan and post it online at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottes, Dina Geisler, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Today's topic will be the Donald Trump and the media landscape.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Oregon Cannabis Growers Fair starting Saturday, August 13th at 10 a.m. and ending Sunday, August 14th, 2016 at 4 p.m. at the Oregon State Fairgrounds in Salem. For the first time ever, Oregon's producers will be able to display live plants at the Cannabis Fair. Over 60 grows will be showcased this year, and there will be awards for the winning plants in several categories. Again, that's the Oregon Cannabis Growers Fair starting Saturday, August 13th at 10 a.m. and ending Sunday, August 14th at 4 p.m. at the Oregon State Fairgrounds, 2330 17th Street, Northeast in Salem. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 9th Annual Beloved Festival, an open-air sacred art and music festival in Tidewater, Oregon, held on August 12th through the 15th. It features a diverse lineup of music, workshops, and presentations across the festival grounds. Beloved will highlight the most cutting-edge electronic music and explore ancient traditions, illustrating the similarities between all of humanity. Again, that's the 9th Annual Beloved Music and Arts Festival, August 12th through the 15th in Tidewater, Oregon. More information can be found online at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Tom Dwyer Automotive Services, a full-service automotive shop located next to Portland's Selwood Bridge for over 30 years. They're a Blue Seal certified shop committed to client care and community support. Information on their eco certification, client carbon neutral program, courtesy shuttle, rentals, and more at tomdwyer.com. Or by calling 503-230-2300.
Oh, I don't believe it. Don't touch me. Hey, Ray. Hey, Sugar. Tell them who we are.
Well, we're big rock singers. We got golden fingers. And we're loved everywhere we go.
That sounds like us.
We sing about beauty and we sing about truth. $10,000 a show,
right?
We take all kind of pills that give us all kind of thrills, but the thrill we've never known is the thrill that'll get you when you get your picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Rolling Stone.
Wanna see my picture on the cover?
Stone.
Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother?
Yes. Stone.
Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of
the Rolling Stone.
I remember the beginning of the Rolling Stone.
Yeah, do you?
I'm so old.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is KBOO 90.7 FM.
Portland, I didn't give you any pushback on that.
No, you didn't.
Just let that one go.
In Portland, Oregon, it is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. That's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Uris. And the number to call?
503-231-8187.
That's correct.
This might come as a surprise.
Yes.
We're going to talk about Donald Trump today.
Oh, not Donald Trump
again.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
He likes fast food.
He does. And, you know, we're not going to be stuck in this Trump rut until November.
No.
I promise you that.
Okay. I want to talk about environmental disaster.
Yes. But not today.
No.
No. Why are we talking about Trump
why, this week? Why?
Well, that's sort of a rhetorical question. I'm asking on behalf of our audience who might be wondering,
Why are they talking about Trump?
Why? Yeah.
Well, because he's something of an anomaly. He's an outlier. He is not a candidate as we traditionally understand candidates to be.
Well, I want to actually focus in on the whole function of the news reporting in this phenomenon.
Well, yes. Mm-hmm.
And I want to talk about how NBC, I believe it was NBC, created Trump. You know, you're fired. Mm-hmm. The Apprentice, that whole the Apprentice with stars.
Yeah.
All of that. And essentially, it created this idea, this model of a human being who gets revenge. It's just like having, being a worshiper of a movie star. If you're powerless, as many people are, if you're underpaid, as many people are, if you're unemployed, as many people are, if you're a white male, as some people are, you feel angry, aggrieved, and upset. You think that suddenly things have shifted in such a manner that persons of color have advantage, that the job structure disadvantages you. Because indeed, the jobs that used to exist, the industrial jobs, the simple jobs, are gone. They're gone. And those that remain of that type are paying terrible wages. And you are left behind in a backwash of a new age, a new post-industrial society. And that's very aggravating. It's hurtful to your masculinity if you're a man. It's very, very, very frustrating. And along comes Donald Trump and says, hey, look, I'm a pig and it's cool.
I'm going to make America great again.
Exactly.
I'm going to come down hard on all the people who have put you in your current predicament.
Right.
The brown people.
Yes.
The women.
The women. Oh.
Yeah. The liberals.
Yeah. Oh, liberals. They're terrible.
The heathens and the atheists.
Now.
The commies.
Well, years ago, we would remember that after World War II, the enemy was the Soviet Union.
Right.
And the so-called Soviet bloc. And they too presented a threat. But it was an external threat, even though there was an internal communist menace, which was, of course, McCarthy and all those people attacked.
Yeah, interesting you brought him up. We're going to circle back to him in a little while.
McCarthy. I think we should circle back to him.
Yep.
Metaphorically
speaking. And literally, actually.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay.
So we're going to use, as a jumping off point for today's conversation, an article that appeared in yesterday's New York Times. The headline reads, Trump is testing the norms of objectivity in journalism. So the norms of objectivity in journalism, such as they are, we're going to talk about in just a minute. But I want to read you the opening couple paragraphs from this article. It starts out, if you're a working journalist and you believe that Donald J. Trump is a demagogue playing to the nation's worst racist and nationalist tendencies, that he cozies up to anti-American dictators, and that he would be dangerous with control of the United States nuclear codes, how the heck are you supposed to cover him? Because if you believe all of those things, you have to throw out the textbook American journalism has been using for the better part of the past half century, if not longer, and approach it in a way you've never approached anything in your career. If you view a Trump presidency as something that's potentially dangerous, then your reporting is going to reflect that. You would move closer than you've ever been to being oppositional. That's uncomfortable and uncharted territory for every mainstream, non-opinion journalist I've ever known, and by normal standards, untenable. So this reporter is asking the question, sort of the meta question in terms of journalists. If Trump is so far out of bounds, should your reporting reflect that fact?
Well, I mean, the answer to me is obvious. But beyond that, there's a set of assumptions there that are absolutely lies. The notion that journalism is somehow at some point neutral. Never been true, not true now.
That's true, yeah.
And the notion, which we've seen disappear, that a story should, within the first few paragraphs, contain who, what, where, when, how, and why, has long gone away.
And had multiple sources.
Yep. One of the rules I learned during journalism was you had to have at least two sources before you went with something.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's gone.
And you only go with an anonymous source if you have no other recourse.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. So let's unpack that a little bit. What is this myth of journalistic objectivity? As you mentioned, Joe, journalism has never been objective, even though it's pretended to be for a long time. But the more reputable news outlets hew to, or attempt to hew to, a set of standards that brings their reporting closer to something that is fair and objective. It approaches objectivity, but can't get there. And it does so by adhering to this set of standards we just talked about. Two sources, avoidance of anonymous sources, if at all possible. The solicitation of differing points of view, so on and so forth. Really a commitment to not putting something in print that you don't know to be true.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, but of course the stance from which all of this journalism flows is an establishmentarian stance, always.
Yeah, very much so.
And the norm is incredibly conservative, really. And I've watched this over the years, both locally and nationally. The big breakthrough was when the Washington Post discovered the incredibly creepy and illegal activities of the Nixon administration.
Right.
With the Watergate break-in and so on. But that did not last. And in my experience locally, I saw stories being written out of whole fantasy at the Oregonian and what was then the Oregon Journal. And it was just the norm. It was just the way it was. In fact, I wrote a PhD dissertation talking about two views of the vice situation in Portland, which really had to do with power relations in the city. And that was a conflict having to do with the number of readers rather than having to do with the truth.
Right. But the point I think we're trying to establish is that journalism writ large has historically, at least in the modern era, had some sort of passing relationship with the truth.
Yes. It waived, if not,
right.
if not went to bed with.
Striving to get there, if not arriving there.
Now, I'm not sure it strived to get there. Because I think, I've always thought that journalism, from the earliest times in America, really was what it was called yellow journalism. By the way, the term yellow journalism refers to a comic strip that the Hearst people had, which was very popular, called The Yellow Kid, who was an Irish-American person and his neighborhood. And he wore a big yellow shirt and nothing else.
Hmm.
And hence the concept of yellow journalism.
And I think you can argue that since the advent of cable TV news and the 24-hour news cycle that began in the 1980s,
right,
that this commitment to objectivity and truth, however tenuous, has gotten worse, has diminished over time. Until you look at the current media landscape, where there are very few places you can go, proudly, I think we can say KABU is among them, where people still adhere to these to this commitment to objectivity. Certainly, you're not going to find it on television news.
No, although, I mean, you do have identifiable points or perspectives. Fox News is right-wing crazy with very attractive people presenting the material.
But that's what you call the entire realm that now exists that didn't used to exist, opinion journalism. Entire TV networks are dedicated to opinion journalism.
Or infotainment.
Infotainment, yes.
And then MSNBC, counter to that, has very authoritative individuals who essentially are arguing or hewing to what I would call the center liberal line.
Certainly, but I think to an extent that's a false equivalence, because MSNBC does not have, first of all, the raw numbers of viewers that Fox News does, and nor is it as ideologically skewed as Fox News is.
I don't know about that latter part. I think that the very notion that is preached, that is objectivity, is at its best simply a question of selection of material. So what are you emphasizing? What are you looking at? Mm-hmm. Now, is there an objective truth? Yes. Do we know what it is and how it is presented? No. Because if any news show, and it's particularly true of local news, always has the same pattern. There is the thing you can watch with some degree of comfort is the weather and the sports. And then the happy story at the end of the segment. It's a pattern. Every station hews to it, and it tries to build its little star group, who are usually no more informed than anyone randomly selected.
So the question then: do normal? I'm putting in air quotes here. Normal journalistic standards apply to a candidate like Donald Trump, and if not, what should take their place? That's the question that this Times article is addressing. And that's what we're going to get into today. And what that means as the rest of this campaign plays out. And here's just a small example of what I mean. traditional political reporting, if Trump were a normal candidate and this were a normal election, you would have the two major party candidates from whom the next president is going to be chosen. We can talk all day long about third party candidates, but let's face it, no third party candidate is going to be elected in this election or any of the previous umpteen election cycles. Okay? Okay.
Well, wait. Okay, I'll agree to that. But going way back, remember the Republican Party was the third party.
Way back. Okay. Yeah. But farther back than any of our lifetimes.
Okay.
So typical campaign journalism would present both candidates, report on what they've said, talk about their policy positions. There'd be some analysis, so on and so forth. That's typical campaign reporting. But if you have a candidate like Trump, how do you tackle him? How do you tackle a guy who has proposed banning an entire world faith from entry into the United States? How do you report on a guy who wants to build a wall across our entire southern border and ask our neighboring nation to pay for it? How do you report on a guy who invited a belligerent government, Russia, to hack his opponent's databases? How do you deal with that guy?
I think there's a simple answer, which is not being played out. And this is what's kind of interesting to me. Every time any candidate, whether it's Hillary or Trump or whatever, any candidate makes a claim and says thus and so is the case, the journalist's job is to look at databases and at information sources and see if that's true. And in the story where the quote is made, show that it is or is not true, more or less. And that is not happening.
No, that's not happening.
So there's a real problem. And there's no way to be objective if you allow a liar to lie.
Yeah, precisely. And then the larger question, if Donald Trump represents an existential threat to the constitutional order as we understand it, should reporting reflect that? And I think the answer is yes, it should.
Well, I agree. And I also think that there's been an incredible desire to present all of what's happened politically since the first Clinton, or since even before that, since Reagan, as it's all normal and it's all okay. The fact of the matter is it's gone way off the tracks. It's not okay. And it is often less than what should be in the way of accurate reporting. Moreover, it's often not about how things really are, what's really going on.
Agreed. And let's be honest here. This malaise of journalism that we're talking about, this is nothing new. Really, what before the downfall of print journalism that we're experiencing right now, back when every city and every town had an active and vigorous local paper, when newspapers were able to afford a staff of reporters who could, for example, spend several months working an in-depth investigatory piece with no real deadline looming, that was journalism in the public interest. That was a public service. When we've entered an era now where newspapers have either folded or downsized to the extent that they can't do that anymore, investigative journalism has largely gone by the wayside. Papers in particular, and television networks and radio networks as well, have become less journalists than they have become simply stenographers for those in power.
Well, and entertainment centers. I mean, when your local news story has degenerated to, I mean, local news program has degenerated to the point where the formula consists of the weather, the sports, the closing human interest story. I mean, you really lost any information. Occasionally, a story will come out that reflects actual issues, but that's not necessarily the pattern.
And if you if you've listened to this show for any length of time, you know that we've been longtime critics of this tendency of mainstream journalism towards stenography and away from actual reporting and actual journalism. And it's been going on for some time.
And also what has happened is that the newspaper industry, the print media industry, has, of course, become digital media and has most of its work put up on digital sites. And beyond all that, there is a tendency to create systems that removed the function of reporters almost entirely. I'm thinking of Tronc, and I'm thinking of Sheldon Adelson, who is who built his fortune on gambling, who is essentially an advocate, uncritical advocate of Israel, who is essentially an uncritical advocate of very conservative ideas, who has enormous power now, enormous power in media. And he's not unique. I picked him out. We could look at Fox News. We could look at the enormous growth of an incredible, powerful establishment coming out of Australia and England and then the United States. And this is incredible, incredible.
Yeah, it really is. And in terms of political reporting, especially here in the United States, instead of substantive reporting on matters of policy, issues of import to working people, instead we get coverage of personalities. Which president would you rather have a beer with? You get coverage of the horse race aspect of the presidency. Oh, who's ahead in which poll and by how much, and so on. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a sideshow, as you just mentioned, a source of entertainment rather than the public service it really needs. Some friends and I had a little fun with this on Facebook yesterday, and we came up with fake headlines reflect this brand of shoddy journalism.
Okay.
I'm going to share a few with them.
Okay.
Trump says Earth is flat. Clinton fails to respond. GOP claims sun to rise in west. Some Democrats disagree. Hillary's menopause dodge. Why she can't match Trump's virility.
That's creepy. That really is actually creepy.
Trump says Mexicans are rapists. Point and counterpoint. So, and on and on and on. But this really, I mean, it's tongue-in-cheek, certainly, but this reflects the state of modern political journalism.
Well,
it's become a he said, she said thing rather than journalism in the service of the Republic.
And beyond the question of journalism itself, there's the question of education. There is this thing called supply-side economics, mm-hmm. which has been pushed by the Republicans, which argues essentially a trickle-down theory. That is, if the rich get richer, eventually that money will somehow fall into all of our pockets. It's been shown not to be true at all. But beyond that is the fact that they're ignoring the fact that if workers, ordinary people, you and I, don't have enough money, we can't buy the crap that's being made. And if we don't buy that, then the economy is very poor, very weak. And that's largely ignored. The emphasis on supply side rather than demand. When I went to high school, we learned a very primitive sort of economics, but we always learned that there was supply
yep.
and demand.
Right. You guys
demand
were like,
being half of it.
You guys were bartering livestock and stuff back then, right?
Bartering livestock?
Yeah, very simple economics.
I'm going to just
okay.
slide over that.
All right.
Okay.
Continue, please.
Yeah. No, I think it's really important. And education generally has become less and less really informative. Having been in my long life an instructor and a professor teaching both at the community college level and at the university level, I have encountered an incredible degree of general ignorance. And it's very powerful and it's very compelling. And often it's rooted in teachings of a kind of weird fundamentalist religion, I have to say.
How about we take a few phone calls?
I think we should take a few phone calls.
Okay, who's first, Steve? Jeremy, good morning.
Hello. Oh, boy, that was a long, long schlep. Okay, it was interesting you started with the Rolling Stone bit because on Amy Goodman, Matt Taibbi's article, which sadly my internet's out, so I can't read it. But he was making a fascinating point about if the Republicans are paying attention, you know, they have a chance to do something. As a Jew on my dead parents' side, I hate the overuse of the Hitler reference. But all those people that voted for Hitler, not all of them, but a great many of them were communists fairly earlier. That's not happening in America. I don't see left Democrats becoming Trumpoids. It's mostly Reagan Democrats or something. But,
I'm not sure. Jeremy, I have to interrupt you here. I'm not sure that where you're getting the basis of the idea that left-wingers flipped and voted for Hitler.
There's substantial evidence that there was a significant
But let's not get sidetracked there. Let's not go down that road
today.
What
seems to be going on in America is that if Republicans read Taibbi
And Trump doesn't pull out, because I think unless something bizarre happens, he's going to lose. But if the Republicans are smart, they have a real opportunity here to become the, you know, anti-NAFTA and anti-TPP America First party. That's a horrible disaster. I mean, the Democrats are horrible for disaster, too, but. I can't wait.
Oh, we're losing your signal, man. We're going to have to let you go. I'm sorry.
No, I'm back. At least you're back.
Well, wind up, Jeremy, please.
Okay. Anyway, well, I just have to sleep because you've been on so long. I would like to encourage all Oregonians. Since, you know, I don't think Trump's ever come close to getting close to 40%, to really vote their conscience, whatever the hell that is. There's only 8 or 10 states where you have to consider voting for, you know, the disaster known as hilarious. And, you know, if I lived in one of those states, I'd be pulling my hair out because I really wouldn't want it. But we don't have to. And there's absolutely nothing that suggests we you know, that anything's going to change whereby we have to. And I would love to see Jill Stein you know, get 25% of the vote here. Of course, that means Trump would win, so it's not going to happen. But anyway, to quote Eugene Debs, it's better to vote for something you want and not get it than to vote for something you don't want and to get it. And for the next 8 years of the grotesque Clintonian dynasty, we can think about that.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, who's next? Sean, good morning.
Good morning, guys. Hey, if anything explains the rise of Donald Trump, it's got to be, without any shadow of a doubt, it has to be the decision by the Democratic Party to throw labor unions and poor people under the bus. Thomas Frank, in his latest book, Listen Liberal, Whatever Happened to the Party of the People, that book lays it all out. The Democratic Party has... This is almost a direct quote. Thomas Frank says that the Democratic Party has connived in the destruction of American labor unions. It takes the money from labor unions and then turns around and connives in the ultimate demolition and destruction of labor unions. So if that doesn't explain the rise of Donald Trump, I don't know what does. It's pretty straightforward. It's not very mysterious. So if you guys want to take that and run with it... I'd appreciate it. Thanks.
Well, thank you for the comment. It is an interesting point that he makes. I don't know that I agree with all of it. But fundamentally, the classic Roosevelt era Democratic Party has pretty much disappeared, although the language of it still exists. And I think he makes a good point in that respect. I also think that nobody is willing to embrace the fact that it is now a world economy, and that the function of the United States as a massive producer of industrial goods is over. It really is over. It doesn't have to be over. It doesn't mean it couldn't come back, but it's over. Just like nobody wants to acknowledge on the right the fact that coal is not a good fuel in this age of global warming, and that, in fact, that means that states like West Virginia are in terrible economic trouble. People whose whole careers were built around digging in the ground, they have nothing to do, really. There's no work for them. And that means that they are angry. And that means that a guy like Trump can come up with some weird promises about restoring America as a kind of fortress nation separate from the rest of the world. Trump, as you know, loves Brexit, which is an insane thing to have happened.
Brexit.
An insane thing to happen. And I think that there is a very great likelihood that all of this anger will manifest itself basically in an angry, sexist, reactionary political movement, which could very well make Trump the president of the United States.
I tend to doubt it, but you're right. It's entirely possible. So let's take another call, and I want to circle back to something else. Annalisa, good morning.
Good morning. I would like both of you to try and get Jill Stein, Dr. Jill Stein, for an interview. She has apparently 5% right now, and she needs 15% to be even included in the debates. And I think that people should start really seriously thinking and then acting upon voting for her. and her vice president candidate. I would really like to encourage you to try and get her for an interview on the telephone as soon as possible and ask her any question that is possible to see what she's coming from. I saw her first, I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but I saw her first on Bill Moyers years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And she was so impressive with her views and her clear thinking. And then I saw her again sometime later on Bill Moyers. And I knew that she would be a very viable candidate for the presidency, but you don't hear hardly about her except Amy Goodman had her on. I don't know if it was yesterday or last week. And she is just very, very impressive. So I would really like you, both of you, to try and interview her and see what people then can come up with. Because I think it is just really not fair that she is not even included in the debates.
Well, I agree with you not about the question of fairness, and I also think that the fact that we have a two-party establishment is unfortunate, and that both parties represent different aspects of the same structure.
But if she can get into the debates, more people will see and hear her, and then maybe she has a chance of winning the presidency. So anyway,
okay.
I love the rain, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. I wouldn't mind reaching out to her or having her reach out to us.
No, I would enjoy having her.
And I wouldn't even mind hearing from
the Libertarian?
Libertarian guy.
Huh.
Guys.
We'll see what we can do. Okay, so I want to follow on with our journalism in the era of Trump theme here. There was another period in the not-too-distant past when a major political figure got so far out of bounds that his rhetoric represented a danger to the Republic, as we understand it. And I'm talking about Senator Joseph McCarthy in the 1950s.
Ah.
Now, you alluded to him earlier in the program. So give us the 30-second nutshell summation of Joseph McCarthy.
Well, we, after the end of the World War II, the United States pivoted into a position of opposition to a former ally, the Soviet Union, who was an ally of convenience, in the recognition of the fact that the Soviets had won the war. By the way, folks, in the European theater, the real victor was the Soviet Union. We lost many lives. We fought hard. We helped that victory, but we were not the prime force in it. And that's something Americans don't really understand. The result of that was that Russia gained control of all of Eastern Europe and Central Europe, a fact on the ground. And Stalinism, which is a deep perversion of Marxism, became the order of the day in that part of the world. It also was perceived as a significant challenge to a capitalist economic system. In the course of that period of time, particularly during the 30s and into the 40s, a large number of American progressives, looking for a home, looking for a place to be supported, embraced organizations that were allied with or were, in fact, part of the communist movement, the Comintern, the International Communist Movement. Most of them were not in any way advocates of betrayal of the United States, but they were so betrayed by people like Joe McCarthy. McCarthy essentially played on fears of that era during a period of time when the U.S. was rearming to fight and even perhaps have a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. This was all real. And in that period, free speech really took a beating. And Joe McCarthy made up data, made up facts, embraced and had support of people like Roy Cohen, who essentially were about the business of making America not a democracy. And it took brave conservatives, actually, to take him down when he actually challenged the army. And that is an amazing story.
So we have a clip this morning that we would like to play. This is the great TV news anchor Edward R. Murrow, CBS News, one of the giants of the genre. He did a special report on Joseph McCarthy, challenging him challenging his statements and challenging the entire premise of his position. And this represented a departure from the journalistic practices of the day in response to a guy who was dangerous, much as Trump is dangerous today. So here's Edward R. Murrow, 1954. Do we have that clip, Steve?
Earlier, the senator asked, upon what meat does this our Caesar feed? Had he looked three lines earlier in Shakespeare's Caesar, he would have found this line, which is not altogether inappropriate. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. No one familiar with the history of his country can deny that congressional committees are useful. It is necessary to investigate before legislating. But the line between investigating and persecuting is a very fine one, and the junior senator from Wisconsin has stepped over it repeatedly. His primary achievement has been in confusing the public mind as between the internal and the external threats of communism. We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law. We will not walk in fear one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason if we dig deep in our history and our doctrine and remember that we are not descended from fearful men. Not from men who feared to write, to speak, to associate, and to defend causes that were for the moment unpopular. This is no time for men who oppose Senator McCarthy's methods to keep silent, or for those who approve. We can deny our heritage and our history, but we cannot escape responsibility for the result. There is no way for a citizen of a republic to abdicate his responsibilities. As a nation, we have come into our full inheritance at a tender age. We proclaim ourselves, as indeed we are, the defenders of freedom wherever it continues to exist in the world. But we cannot defend freedom abroad by deserting it at home. The actions of the junior senator from Wisconsin have caused alarm and dismay amongst our allies abroad and given considerable comfort to our enemies. And whose fault is that? Not really his. He didn't create this situation of fear. He merely exploited it, and rather successfully. Cassius was right. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. Good night, and good luck.
So there you have it. McCarthy was out of line. McCarthy's rhetoric was dangerous. And that needed to be said, and it needed to be said by prominent journalists, and Murrow came out and said it.
Well, and you're focusing on McCarthy as if there wasn't a whole host of activities on the part of congressional investigators and so on, which essentially, for example, supported the owner class in Hollywood to destroy the creative efforts of writers and actors and directors who made movies that had cultural relevance.
Yeah.
And we moved into the age of the musical. You know, we moved into an age of harmless film. And that was a great artistic loss, not to mention a great loss of freedom. The closing down of Hollywood was a significant impactor. The same was true in many, many other fields. In amazingly bad timing, the American Civil Liberties Union at that time, let me be clear, it's an excellent organization today, at that time allowed the FBI to vet its membership. And this is incredible. So much of what was done at that time reflects fear and paranoia and essentially a notion that the only way to defeat the menace of Soviet ideology was in some way to silence dissent at home.
Yeah, I focus on McCarthy because he's a useful example now that we all live in the shadow of Donald Trump. Okay.
The shadow of Donald Trump?
Yeah, it was a poetic turn of phrase. Give me a break.
Okay.
Jeez, man. All right. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on alternative radio, physicist, scholar, and activist Vandana Shiva speaks on We Are All Seeds. At 10, Air Cascadia and Flashpoints are off today. We'll hear Law and Disorder, which looks at a legal struggle around an ordinance in Pennsylvania that legalizes direct action to stop fracking. We also hear about a federal court's invalidation of voting restrictions enacted in North Carolina. At 11, Stages Studio is off this week. We'll hear an episode of Sprouts on the music of the climate movement. What sounds, what songs, what spoken word stories will be the ones that get through to the public to help organize a global movement around climate change? Find out at 11. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Andre Middleton hosts a Share Your Art News call-in show. All this and more coming up today on KBOO. So, this is the Abe and Joe Talk radio program. The number to call, 503-231-8187. We're also taking your written comments on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/Abe and Joe. We're also on the Twitter machine at HonestAbe72. Susan writes into the Facebook page to say, my mother went to high school with Eric Severide, the late CBS television journalist who was prominent in the 1970s. Many years ago, I recall hearing Severide say something like the following, and she paraphrases, it is not ever possible for journalism to be completely objective, but journalism can be fair. And I think that sums up what you and I are, what you and I believe the responsibility of journalism to be, which is to get as close to the truth as possible.
Yeah, but always remember, and this is really important, that the newspapers, that which were at one point the main source of knowledge for most people, have always been in the hands of various elements of the ruling class, sometimes more liberal, sometimes less so.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's also the case, people have this idea that the New York Times is somehow a bastion of liberalism. It actually never was and isn't.
No.
It is more a bastion of factual reporting than most other sources. But when I worked for the Oregonian, and I worked for them part-time for quite a while, and when I worked for Willamette Week when it first started, the goals were, in my case, to report stuff that essentially was not being reported in the mainstream of those publications. And then, as the Oregonian moved away from being an actual print medium, that opportunity disappeared. Moreover, because it's no longer a newspaper, really. Moreover, the Oregonian threw its labor unions out in late 1950s, along with the Oregon Journal, made a secret deal to buy the Oregon Journal, and waged war against organized labor, which was absolutely successful. So you have a distant ownership out of New York, essentially creating a whole other kind of newspaper, and over the long run, while allowing that paper to be a good functioning newspaper, eventually made sure, in terms of the changing climate of technology, that paper would turn into nothing, which is what it is pretty much now.
And variations of the story have played out in cities across the nation.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And now, of course, I believe that most of what young people are learning in school is not adequate to the situation the nation is in. And there is an enormous force at work, always has been at work, in teaching history and economics, in the social sciences generally, to teach that everything's okay. You know, I can remember, and this is not that long ago, that we were taught, oh yes, slavery was bad, but African peoples could work better in the sun. And I can also remember people arguing, well, yeah, and I hear this argument today, yeah, they were slaves, but they had more caloric intake, they had a better situation, more security than the working class. And that's real.
Michelle Obama gave a speech, a really good one, at the Democratic National Convention, in which she talked about waking up every day in a house that was built by slaves. The next day, Bill O'Reilly on Fox News countered by saying, oh, but they were really well-fed slaves.
Oh, yeah.
And their working conditions were really quite good.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well.
That's Fox News, ladies and
gentlemen. Well, and I've had arguments when I was traveling in the South, serious arguments by people who would say, presumably educated people, well, but the caloric intake, the lifestyle, the homes, the cottages, the cabins, whatever, of slaves were much better than the slums and the horrible diet of working class people in the North. And I can remember saying at one point, yeah, there's one thing about that, whether or not that's true, there's one thing about that you got to remember. What's that? Well, they weren't free. And the concept, the notion of freedom, is the thing that is largely ignored in those kinds of arguments.
Indeed. I also had an educated Southerner once tell me that the slave owners were never compensated for the loss of their property after the Civil War.
That's right.
Right. Okay.
Nor were black people compensated for their slavery.
No, that's very true. Yes, it is. Very true. Okay, so we heard that clip from Edward R. Murrow. I want to touch on one thing that he mentioned. He said, speaking of Joseph McCarthy, he didn't create the situation of fear. He merely exploited it, and rather successfully. The exact same thing is true of Donald Trump. I hear prominent Republicans, prominent conservatives right now condemning Trump, condemning his words, condemning his actions, condemning his policy positions. But you know what? Too damn bad. Trump did not create the culture of fear and racism and xenophobia that propelled him into power. He merely exploited it. He would not be where he is. He would not be a major party nominee if there wasn't a significant chunk of the conservative electorate that voted him in there.
Well, and beyond that, he would not be even known if it hadn't been for the opportunism of, I think it's NBC, to put his stupid show on the air.
I disagree. People knew who he was long before he had his reality show. But you're right that he that put him in front of millions of eyeballs,
yeah.
You know, a couple times a week or however often. I've never seen his show, so I don't know.
You're fired.
Trump would not be Trump. Trump would not be the Democrat or the Republican nominee for president if there weren't a whole lot of racists and xenophobes and authoritarians and fascist nationalists in the country who voted for him.
No,
so
well,
me a river, mainstream Republicans. You made this bed. Now you got to sleep in it.
Labeling the people who are supporting Trump with those labels is largely true, but it must be remembered that most people in this society who have worked for a living in well-paying jobs and who saw their children as being able potentially to do much better, to have middle-class positions, in fact, to go to college and so on, all of that has disappeared. There is a reason for all this anger. And without an analysis, particularly a class analysis, without information, it is really easy for a fascist to become a dominant figure. And that's where Trump's at.
Yeah, yes, there is a reason for this anger. But for the typical white working class family whose fortunes have fallen over the past several decades, as these jobs were going away, as their wages were declining, as their benefits were being taken away, as their pensions disappeared, they were being fed a toxic stew of racism and xenophobia by the very people who were taking away their livelihood. That is the moneyed establishment of the Republican Party. So they created this monster. And now they've got Donald Trump. So how's that working out for you, conservatives? How's that working out for you? Should we go back to the phones?
I think so.
All right. Who's next?
Enough of your ranting.
Francis,
let's go to the phones.
Good morning.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
It's interesting that you're speaking, that you played that Edward R. Murrow discussion of fear. And then we speak of the shadow of Trump,
mm-hmm.
and how he's being used now as something to fear. And then your last caller suggested that you reach out to Jill Stein and have her come to speak, or one of her surrogates. And you said, well, maybe they'll approach us. And I'm trying to determine right now what progressive really means. Because you're just reiterating all the media hype about Trump, about him inviting Russia to hack. That's not what he said. He was joking when he said it, and everyone who listened to it knew that's what he was doing.
Huh.
But the notion of, he said, Senator McCarthy was an elected senator who held these hearings. It was a totally different scenario going on there. Now, Trump is talking all this stuff, but he hasn't actually done anything. Ms. Clinton has done many, 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 many things and continues to do many, many, many things while we are talking about the shadow of Trump.
I think, now, Francis, let me just interject quickly. I think if the prospect of a Trump presidency doesn't scare you, you're not paying close enough attention.
What scares me right now is that a young man was shot in the back by the police again in Chicago, and that a young woman had her house broken into. She was killed, and her little 5-year-old boy was shot by the police, and no one seems to give a dang about it, but they're afraid of Trump. There are people already living what you're afraid of.
Hillary Clinton has done nothing
to stop them and to prevent it, and actually did things to allow it to continue. So if the progressive radio station KABU cannot even invite Jill Stein or one of her surrogates to speak and talk about what their issues really are and the real issues that are facing the people in our country, then I don't know what progressive means. I think it means maybe maintaining the status quo and pretending like we care.
Hmm.
You guys take care.
Okay, thanks for the comment.
Frances just gave us both barrels, Joe.
Well, I think she makes a good point. This is an interesting problem, and I've run into this problem over the years often. There are minor parties, some of them with excellent political agendas and plans from the left, not to mention ones on the right, but from the left, that largely are systematically ignored. And the question of what to do about these parties in the face of what are perceived, at least, as greater dangers is a very real one. I have no brief about whether or not to have Jill Stein on the air. I don't believe that she will be a relevant force, but you never know. And I do believe that if her people were to reach out to us, and I do believe, by the way, that the job of a candidate is to reach out, not the opposite. That is, it's not our job to hunt her up, it's really her job to reach out to us. And that's kind of a measure of her effectiveness. And if that happens, I would certainly put her on the air. But I'm not going to spend a lot of time trying to get her, because I personally am extremely concerned about the fact that this actual, real, honest-to-God fascist is very likely to end up being president of the United States. One of the things that I always had thought might be true about this guy is that there is an underreporting of his support, because people who are supporting him have been made to feel embarrassed about him. So I just really, really, really am very frightened. And the reason why I'm frightened hasn't got to do with left or right politics. It has to do with crazy. It's as simple as that. The man is crazy.
All right, before we go back to the phones, I want to read. There's three tweets came in from a listener, David. First one, true objectivity would require acknowledging that, objectively speaking, Trump is the biggest liar who's ever run for president of the United States. The next tweet,
I don't know if that's fair. There have been a lot of big liars.
He's a pretty big liar. Having done print for 25 years and investigative work for as long as a year on one story, I can say it is simply not possible anymore. And finally, the drive for profit has stripped newsrooms to skeletons. The internet has shattered attention spans. A perfect storm. Sad. He tweets.
Whoever sent you that is absolutely right.
Yeah,
might
exactly.
Be somebody I even know.
Yeah,
maybe
the demise of local newspapers is to the detriment of the citizenry.
Well, the demise of the print press, the fact that the press is now in the hands, has always been in the hands of moneyed interests, but now in a kind of concerted way has become a maximizer of profit rather than a maximizer of knowledge, is very sad and very dangerous. And remember that the idea from the early creation of this country that a free press was so important, it's enshrined in the First Amendment, means nothing when it's all about money.
The free press, yes, is enshrined in the First Amendment as a necessary counter to the abuses of government and the abuses of private sector power.
Right.
That's why the free press exists.
Right.
And at a local level, when you no longer have viable newspapers, we've really lost something pretty important.
Well, and my historical note that the Oregonian, having been purchased by the Newhouse family, and the Newhouse family making a secret deal, it was a secret deal, to purchase the only oppositional paper, the evening paper, the Journal, had really set the city up for a very bad experience. And all of that was expressed in the smashing of the unions at the Oregonian and the Oregon Journal in, 1959? So, there is a pattern here, and it cannot be ignored. And the smashing of organized labor is a part of that pattern.
Let's go back to the phones. Vernon, good morning.
Good morning. I have a couple of questions before I go into my own rant. First, do you remember historically any time when both major parties nominated the candidate with the highest negative ratings?
This is ignorance on my part. I don't
think it's ever happened.
I don't believe it's ever happened either. I've been watching politics for 60 years now, and it's the first time I ever remember it. I wonder what would happen if we can use enough popular pressure to open the debates to Jill Stein and Gary Johnson and give the American people some real choices.
Well, yeah, you're certainly free to do that. How would you do that?
We can open those debates up.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Well, remember the debate structure was taken over originally. I think it was the League of Women Voters, wasn't it, that ran the debates?
The League had it for years, but it was some 8 years ago it was taken over by the major parties.
Right, and when that happened, that was the end of the possibility, not the probability, but the possibility of multiple candidates appearing in those debates. I doubt very much that it's possible to give either of the marginal candidates, I say marginal only because that's the way it's structured, the opportunity to have or participate in debates. I believe...
They have openly promised that if either candidate can get 15% support, they can get into the debate.
Right. Well, 15% is, given the structure of things, pretty hard to get.
It's tough, but it's doable. And Joe's doing an amazing job of running. And by the way, we will... I'll send word up through the party structure. I'm pretty sure we can get someone from her campaign to contact you and get her.
If
that'd be wonderful.
If her people, particularly if she herself, want to be on, I can only say for the space I and Abe occupy, we'll give her some time. And the same would be true. The same would be true for the what's his name? I can't remember.
Johnson.
Gary Johnson, the Libertarian.
Yeah. But I have seen throughout my life the appearance of good left-wing parties. The last left-wing party that had any real shot at the presidency was in 1948. So, you know, okay. But I do believe that if such parties were given the opportunity, if the structure were more open, we might have a better contest. And I certainly would welcome Jill Stein.
Now my rant, and I'll try to keep it brief.
Okay, make it fast.
From my perspective, gentlemen, the power players who decide our elections are pulling a lot of strings, and Bernie did his job by bringing idealists into the Democratic Party. Trump is doing his job by making a war criminal look like a moderate, and Hillary will do her job by driving the last stakes into the corpse of democracy, such as it ever existed. But we may or may not be able to truly affect that, but we can sure as hell struggle. We can sure as hell work as intelligently to build a community that resists this corporate rule. And I thank you for your role in doing that, and I intend to continue to fight.
Okay, well, I'm gonna expect you to try to reach out and to take on a role that I am not going to be able to do, which is invite Jill Stein to be on our show.
I will definitely follow through on that.
Hey, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
I want to reiterate what I said last week about third parties.
Yes.
My problem is not with third parties per se. In fact, I think that a viable third party candidacy and fourth and fifth and sixth party candidacies are exactly what our representative democracy needs. What I have a problem with is that every 4 years when there's a presidential election, all of a sudden we get this huge chorus of voices calling for us to support the third party candidate when that's not a viable choice. Neither Johnson nor Stein is going to win this election. If we want to put ourselves in a position where they have a chance, then we need to build these third parties and fourth and fifth parties from the ground up over a period of many years, such that when a presidential election rolls around, yes, we can talk seriously about one of these candidates winning the presidency. We are not in a position to do that now. This requires the long, difficult work of building a party at the local level over a period of many years.
Well, and I agree with you, and I think it's a really serious problem. I do not believe that. Remember my argument fundamentally is that we're in late stage capitalism, and that fundamentally the notions that were the founding fathers, no women, no mothers, founding fathers, were about property holders and were for white men of property, not persons of color, not Native Americans, not women. And that really is the fault, serious fault in the creation of this republic.
Agreed. All right, on that happy note, we'll be back at you next week. This has been the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. This is KBOO 90.7 FM. Stay tuned for the best in news and music programming.
Yeah, and maybe we get Jill.
Disorder from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
You know you love KBOO's programming, but did you know you can help inform decisions about new programs on KBOO, support evaluating shows to ensure programming excellence, as well as help process feedback about shows from our listeners? Well, you can when you join the KBOO Programming Advisory Committee. All you need to be is a KBOO member. Attend monthly meetings on the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. at KBOO, and commit 5 hours a month to work on committee-related tasks. The Programming Advisory Committee works alongside KBOO programming staff to live out our programming charter. You can find out more at kboo.fm/committees. See you the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. KBOO needs you.
And good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First on alternative radio, physicist, scholar, and activist Vandana Shiva speaks on We Are All Seeds. At 10, Air Cascadia and Flashpoints are off today. We'll hear Law and Disorder, which looks at a legal struggle around an ordinance in